Yes, I was. I didn't want to worry you. He stared at her. On Robin's other side, she could feel her mother making more notes. This one, he said, pointing at the picture, and she nodded. Why were you on the M4?
I had to drive Cormoran to an interview.
I'm thinking of women, said the interviewer. Your views on women, where the hell was the interview?
Devon,
said Robin.
Devon?
He's boogered his leg again. He couldn't have got there by himself.
You drove him to Devon?
Yes, Matt, I drove him to... So that's why you didn't come up yesterday. So you could...
Matt, of course not.
He flung down the paper, pulled himself up, and strode from the room. Robin felt sick. She looked around at the door, which he had not slammed but closed firmly enough to make her father stir and mutter in his sleep, and the Labrador wake up. Leave him, advised her mother, her eyes still on the screen. Robin swung round, desperate. Cormoran had to get to Devon, and he couldn't drive with only one leg.
There's no need to defend yourself to me, said Mrs. Ellicott.
But now he thinks I lied about not being able to get home yesterday.
Did you?
Her mother asked, her eyes still fixed beadily upon Michael Fancourt.
Get down, Roundtree. I can't see over you.
Well, I could have come if I got a first-class ticket, Robin admitted as the Labrador yawned, stretched and resettled himself on the hearthrug. But I'd already paid for the sleeper.
Matt's always going on about how much more money you would have made if you'd taken that HR job, said her mother, her eyes on the TV screen. I'd have thought he'd appreciate you saving the pennies. Now shush, I want to hear about revenge.
The interviewer was trying to formulate a question. But where women are concerned, you haven't always... Contemporary mores, so-called political correctness... I'm thinking particularly of your assertion that female writers...
This again, said Fancourt, slapping his knees with his hands.
The interviewer perceptibly jumped.
I said that the greatest female writers, with almost no exception, have been childless, a fact. And I have said that women generally, by virtue of their desire to mother, are incapable of the necessarily single-minded focus... Anyone must bring to the creation of literature. True literature. I don't retract a word. That is a fact.
Robin was twisting her engagement ring on her finger, torn between her desire to follow Matt and persuade him she had done nothing wrong, and anger that any such persuasion should be required. The demands of his job came first, always. She had never known him apologize for late hours, for jobs that took him to the far side of London and brought him home at 8 o'clock at night.
I was going to say, the interviewer hurried on, with an ingratiating smile, that this book might give those critics pause.
I thought the central female character was treated with great understanding, with real empathy.
Of course.
He glanced down at his notes and up again. Robin could feel his nerves. Parallels are bound to be drawn. In dealing with the suicide of a young woman, I expect you're braced.
You must be expecting that stupid people will assume that I have written an autobiographical account of my first wife's suicide.
Well, it's bound to be seen as... It's bound to raise questions.
Then let me say this, said Fancourt, and paused.
They were sitting in front of a long window, looking out onto a sunny, windswept lawn. Robin wondered fleetingly when the programme had been filmed, before the snows had come clearly. But Matthew dominated her thoughts. She ought to go and find him, yet somehow she remained on the sofa.
When F. Ellie died, began Fancourt. When she died...
The close-up felt painfully intrusive. The tiny lines at the corner of his eyes deepened as he closed them. A square hand flew to conceal his face. Michael Fancourt appeared to be crying.
So much for love being a mirage and a chimera, sighed Mrs. Ellicott as she tossed down her pen. This is no good. I wanted blood and guts, Michael. Blood and guts.
Unable to stand inaction any longer, Robin got up and headed for the sitting room door. These were not normal circumstances. Matthew's mother had been buried that day. It behoved her to apologize, to make amends. Chapter 35.
We are all liable to mistakes, sir. If you own it to be so, there needs no farther apology.
William Congreve, the old bachelor. The Sunday broadsheets next day strove to find a dignified balance between an objective assessment of Owen Quine's life and work and the macabre, gothic nature of his death. A minor literary figure, occasionally interesting, tipping latterly into self-parody, eclipsed by his contemporaries, but continuing to blaze his own outmoded trail, said the Sunday Times, in a front-page column that led to a promise of much more excitement within. A sadist's blueprint, see pages 10 to 11. And, beside a thumbnail photograph of Kenneth Halliwell, Books and Bookmen, Literary Killers, page 3, Culture. Rumours about the unpublished book that allegedly inspired his murder are now spreading beyond London's literary circles, the Observer assured its readers. Were it not for the dictates of good taste, Roper Chard would have had an instant bestseller on its hands. Kinky writer disemboweled in sex game, declared the Sunday People. Strike had bought every paper on his way home from Nina Lascelles, difficult though it was to manage them all and his stick over snowy pavements. It occurred to him, as he struggled towards Denmark Street, that he was unwisely encumbered, should his would-be assailant of the previous evening reappear. But she was nowhere to be seen. Later that evening, he worked his way through the news stories while eating chips, lying on his bed with his prosthetic leg mercifully removed once more. Viewing the facts through the press's distorting lens was stimulating to his imagination. At last, having finished Culpepper's piece in the News of the World, sources close to the story confirm that Quine liked to be tied up by his wife, who denies that she knew the kinky writer had gone to stay in their second home. Strike slid the papers off his bed, reached for the notebook he kept by his bed, and scribbled himself a list of reminders for the following day. He did not add Anstice's initial to any of the tasks or questions, but Bookshop Man and MF when filmed were both followed by a capital R. He then texted Robin, reminding her to keep her eyes peeled for a tall woman in a black coat the following morning, and not to enter Denmark Street if she was there. Robin saw nobody answering that description on her short journey from the tube, and arrived at the office at 9 o'clock next morning to find Strike sitting at her desk and using her computer.
"Morning. No nutters outside?"
"No one,"
said Robin, hanging up her coat.
"How's Matthew?"
"Fine,"
lied Robin.
The aftermath of their row about her decision to drive Strike to Devon clung to her like fumes. The argument had simmered and erupted repeatedly all through their car journey back to Clapham. Her eyes were still puffy from crying and lack of sleep.
"Tough for him," muttered Strike, still frowning at the monitor. "His mother's funeral."
"Hmm," said Robin, moving to fill the kettle, and feeling annoyed that Strike chose to empathize with Matthew today, exactly when she would have welcomed an assurance that he was an unreasonable prick.
"What are you looking at?" she asked, setting a mug of tea at Strike's elbow, for which he gave her muttered thanks.
"Trying to find out when Michael Fancourt's interview was filmed," he said. "He was on telly on Saturday night."
"I watch that," said Robin.
"Me too," said Strike.
"Arrogant prat," said Robin, sitting down on the mock-leather sofa, which for some reason did not emit farting noises when she did it. Perhaps, thought Strike, it was his weight.
"Notice anything funny when he was talking about his late wife?" Strike asked.
"The crocodile tears were a bit much," said Robin,
seeing how he'd just been explaining how love's an illusion and all that rubbish. Strike glanced at her again. She had the kind of fair, delicate complexion that suffered from excess emotion. The swollen eyes told their own story. Some of her animosity towards Michael Fancourt, he guessed, might be displaced from another and perhaps more deserving target.
"Thought he was faking, did you?" Strike asked.
"Me too."
He glanced at his watch.
"I've got Caroline Ingalls arriving in half an hour."
"I thought she and her husband had reconciled."
"Old news. She wants to see me, something about a text she found over his phone over the weekend." "So," said Strike, heaving himself up from the desk, "I need you to keep trying to find out when that interview was filmed, while I go and look over the case notes so I look like I can remember what the hell she's on about. Then I've got lunch with Quine's editor."
"And I've got some news about what the doctor's surgery outside Catherine Kent's flat does with medical waste," said Robin.
"Go on," said Strike.
"A specialist company collects it every Tuesday." "I contacted them," said Robin, and Strike could tell by her sigh that the line of inquiry was about to fizzle out, and they didn't notice anything odd or unusual about the bags they collected the Tuesday after the murder. "I suppose," she said, "it was a bit unrealistic, thinking they wouldn't notice a bag of human intestines. They told me it's usually just swabs and needles, and they're all sealed up in special bags."
"Had to check it out, though," said Strike, bracingly. "That's good detective work. Cross off all the possibilities. Anyway, there's something else I need doing, if you can face the snow."
"I'd love to get out," said Robin, brightening at once. "What is it?"
"The man in the bookshop in Putney who reckons he saw Quine on the 8th, said Strike. "He should be back off his holidays."
"No problem," said Robin. She had not had an opportunity over the weekend to discuss with Matthew the fact that Strike wished to give her investigative training. It would have been the wrong time before the funeral, and after their row on Saturday night would have seemed provocative, even inflammatory. Today, she yearned to get out onto the streets, to investigate, to probe, and to go home and tell Matthew matter-of-factly what she had done. He wanted honesty. She would give him honesty. Caroline Ingalls, who was a worn-out blonde, spent over an hour in Strike's office that morning. When finally she had departed, looking tear-stained but determined, Robin had news for Strike. "That interview with Fancourt was filmed on the 7th of November," she said. "I phoned the BBC. Took ages, but I got there in the end."
"The 7th, repeated Strike. "That was a Sunday. Where was it filmed?"
"A film crew went down to his house in Chew Magna," said Robin. "What did you notice on the interview that's making you this interested?"
"Watch it again," said Strike. "See if you can get it on YouTube. Surprised you didn't spot it at the time."
Stung, she remembered Matthew beside her, interrogating her about the crash on the M4.
"I'm going to change for Simpsons," said Strike. "We'll lock up and leave together, shall we?"
They parted 40 minutes later at the Tube, Robin heading for the Bridlington bookshop in Putney, Strike for the restaurant on the Strand, to which he intended to walk.
"Spent way too much on taxis lately," he told Robin gruffly,
unwilling to tell her how much it had cost him to take care of the Toyota Land Cruiser with which he had been stranded on Friday night.
"Plenty of time."
She watched him for a few seconds as he walked away from her, leaning heavily on his stick and limping badly. An observant childhood spent in the company of three brothers had given Robin an unusual and accurate insight into the frequently contrary reaction of males to female concern. But she had wondered how much longer Strike could force his knee to support him before he found himself incapacitated for longer than a few days. It was almost lunchtime, and the two women opposite Robin on the train to Waterloo were chatting loudly, carrier bags full of Christmas shopping between their knees. The floor of the Tube was wet and dirty,
and the air full again of damp cloth and stale bodies. Robin spent most of her journey trying without success to view clips of Michael Fancourt's interview on her mobile phone. The Bridlington Bookshop stood on a main road in Putney, its old-fashioned paned windows crammed from top to bottom with a mixture of new and second-hand books, all stacked horizontally. A bell tinkled as Robin crossed the threshold into a pleasant, mildewed atmosphere. A couple of ladders stood propped against shelves crammed with more horizontally piled books, reaching all the way to the ceiling. Hanging bulbs lit the space, dangling so low that Strike would have banged his head.
"Good morning,"
said an elderly gentleman in an overlarge tweed jacket, emerging with almost audible creaks from an office with a dimpled glass door. As he approached, Robin caught a strong whiff of body odour. She had already planned her simple line of inquiry, and asked at once whether he had any Owen Quine in stock.
Ah, he said knowingly. I needn't ask, I think, why the sudden interest.
A self-important man in the common fashion of the unworldly and cloistered, he embarked without invitation into a lecture on Quine's style and declining readability as he led her into the depths of the shop. He appeared convinced, after 2 seconds' acquaintance, that Robin could only be asking for a copy of one of Quine's books because he had recently been murdered. While this was, of course, the truth, it irritated Robin. "Have you got the Balzac brothers?" she asked.
"You'd know better than to ask for Bombyx Morrie, then," he said, shifting a ladder with his doddery hands. 3 young journalists I've had in here asking for it."
"Why a journalist coming here?" asked Robin innocently, as he began to climb the ladder, revealing an inch of mustard-coloured sock above his old brogues.
"Mr. Quine shopped here shortly before he died," said the old man, now peering at spines some 6 feet above Robin.
Balzac brothers, should be here. Dear, dear, I'm sure I've got a copy."
"He actually came in here, to your shop?" asked Robin.
"Oh, yes. I recognized him instantly. I was a great admirer of Joseph North, and they once appeared on the same bill at the Hay Festival."
He was coming down the ladder now, feet trembling with every step. Robin was scared he might fall.
"I'll check the computer," he said, breathing heavily. "I'm sure I've got a Balzac brothers here."
Robin followed him, reflecting that if the last time the old man had set eyes on Owen Quine had been in the mid-80s, his reliability in identifying the writer again might be questionable.
"I don't suppose you could miss him," she said. "I've seen pictures of him. Very distinctive looking in his Tyrolean cloak."
"His eyes are different colours," said the old man,
now gazing at the monitor of an early Macintosh classic that must, Robin thought, be 20 years old. Beige, boxy, big clunky keys like cubes of toffee.
"You see it close up, one hazel, one blue. I think the policeman was impressed by my powers of observation and recall. I was in intelligence during the war."
He turned upon her with a self-satisfied smile.
"I was right. We do have a copy. Second-hand. This way."
He shuffled towards an untidy bin full of books.
"That's a very important bit of information for the police," said Robin, following him.
"Yes, indeed," he said complacently. "Time of death. Yes, I could assure them that he was alive, still, on the 8th.
"I don't suppose you could remember what he came in here for," said Robin with a small laugh. "I'd love to know what he read."
"Oh, yes, I remember," said her companion at once. "He bought 3 novels, Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, Joshua Ferris's The Unnamed, and I forget the 3rd. Told me he was going away for a break and wanted reading matter. We discussed the digital phenomenon, he more tolerant of reading devices than I.
somewhere in here,
he muttered, raking in the bin. Robin joined the search half-heartedly. The eighth, she repeated. How could you be so sure it was the eighth? For the days, she thought, must blend quite seamlessly into each other in this dim atmosphere of mildew.
It was a Monday, he said. A pleasant interlude discussing Joseph North, of whom he had very fond memories.
Robin was still none the wiser as to why he believed this particular Monday to have been the eighth, but before she could inquire further, he had pulled an ancient paperback from the depths of the bin with a triumphant cry.
There we are! There we are! I knew I had it!
I can never remember dates, Robin lied, as they returned to the till with their trophy. I don't suppose you've got any Joseph North while I'm here.
There was only one, said the old man, towards the mark. Now I know we've got that, one of my personal favourites.
And he headed once more for the ladder.
I confuse days all the time,
Robin soldiered on bravely, as the mustard-coloured socks were revealed again.
Many people do, he said smugly, but I am an adept at reconstructive deduction. Ha ha! I remembered that it was a Monday because always on a Monday I buy fresh milk, and I had just returned from doing so when Mr. Quine arrived at the shop.
She waited while he scanned the shelves above her head.
I explained to the police that I was able to date the particular Monday precisely because that evening I went to my friend Charles's house, as I do most Mondays. But I distinctly remembered telling him about Owen Quine arriving in my bookshop and discussing the five Anglican bishops who had defected to Rome that day. Charles is a lay preacher in the Anglican Church. He felt it deeply.
I see, said Robin, who was making a mental note to check the date of such a defection. The old man had found North's book and was slowly descending the ladder.
Yes, I remember, he said with a spurt of enthusiasm. Charles showed me some remarkable pictures of a sinkhole that appeared overnight in Schmalkalden, Germany. I was stationed near Schmalkalden during the war. Yes, that evening I remember my friend interrupted me telling him about Quine visiting the shop. His interest in writers is negligible. Weren't you in Schmalkalden, he said.
The frail, knobbly hands were busy at the till now.
And he told me a huge crater had appeared. Extraordinary pictures in the paper next day. Memory is a wonderful thing, he said complacently,
handing Robin a brown paper bag containing her two books and receiving her £10 note in exchange.
I remember that sinkhole, said Robin, which was another lie.
She took a mobile out of her pocket and pressed a few buttons while he conscientiously counted the change.
Yes, here it is. Schmalkalden. How amazing. That huge hole appearing out of nowhere.
But that happened, she said, looking up at him, on the 1st of November, not the 8th. He blinked.
No, it was the 8th, he said,
with all the conviction a profound dislike of being mistaken could muster.
But see here,
said Robin, showing him the tiny screen. He pushed his glasses up his forehead to stare at it. You definitely remember discussing Owen Quine's visit and the sinkhole in the same conversation.
Some mistake, he muttered.
And whether he referred to the Guardian website, himself or Robin, was unclear. He thrust her phone back at her.
You don't remember... Is that all?
He said loudly, flustered.
Then good day to you. Good day.
And Robin, recognizing the stubbornness of an offended old egoist, took her leave to the tinkling of the bell. Chapter 36 Mr. Scandal, I shall be very glad to confer with you about these things which he has uttered. His sayings are very mysterious and hieroglyphical. William Congreve, Love for Love. Strike had thought that Simpsons in the Strand was an odd place for Jerry Waldegrave to want to meet for lunch, and his curiosity increased as he approached the imposing stone facade, with its revolving wooden doors, its brass plaques, and hanging lantern. Chess motifs decorated the tiled surround of the entrance.
He had never set foot in there, aged institution though it was.
He had assumed it to be the home of well-heeled businessmen and out-of-towners treating themselves. Yet Strike felt at home as soon as he set foot inside the lobby. Once an 18th-century gentleman's chess club, Simpson spoke to Strike in an old and familiar language of hierarchy, order, and stately decorum. Here were the dark, sludgy clubland colours that men chose without reference to their womenfolk.
Thick marble columns and solid leather armchairs that would support a drunken dandy. And glimpsed beyond the double doors, past the coat check girl, a restaurant full of dark wood panelling.
He might have been back in one of the sergeant's messes he had frequented during his military career. All that was needed to make the place feel truly familiar were regimental colours and a portrait of the Queen. Solid wood-backed chairs, snowy tablecloths, silver salvers on which enormous joints of beef reposed. As Strike sat down at a table for two beside the wall, he found himself wondering what Robin would make of the place, whether she would be amused or irritated by its ostentatious traditionalism. He had been seated for 10 minutes before Waldegrave appeared, peering myopically around the dining room. Strike raised a hand, and Waldegrave made his way with a shambling walk towards their table.
"Hello, hello. Nice to see you again."
His light brown hair was as messy as ever, and his crumpled jacket had a smear of toothpaste on the lapel. A faint gust of vinous fumes reached Strike across the small table.
"Good of you to see me," said Strike.
"Not at all. Want to help. Hope you don't mind coming here."
"I chose it," said Waldegrave, "because we won't run into anyone I know. My father brought me here once years ago. Don't think they've changed a thing."
Waldegrave's round eyes, framed by his horn-rimmed glasses, travelled over the heavy moulded plasterwork at the top of the dark wood panelling.
It was stained ochre, as though tarnished by long years of cigarette smoke.
"You get enough of your co-workers during office hours, do you?" Strike asked.
"Nothing wrong with them," said Jerry Waldegrave, pushing his glasses up his nose and waving at a waiter.
"But the atmosphere's poisonous just now. Glass of red, please," he told the young man who had answered his wave. "I don't care, anything."
But the waiter, on whose front a small knight chess piece was embroidered, answered repressively,
"I'll send over the wine waiter, sir," and retreated.
"See the clock over the doors as you come in here?"
Waldegrave asked Strike, pushing his glasses up his nose again.
"They say it stopped when the first woman came here in 1984. Little in-joke. And on the menu it says, Bill of Fare. They wouldn't use menu, you see, because it was French. My father loved that stuff. I just got into Oxford, that's why he brought me here. He hated foreign food."
Strike could feel Waldegrave's nervousness. He was used to having that effect on people. Now was not the moment to ask whether Waldegrave had helped Quine write the blueprint for his murder.
"What did you do at Oxford?"
"English," said Waldegrave with a sigh. "My father was putting a brave face on it. He wanted me to do medicine."
The fingers of Waldegrave's right hand played an arpeggio on the tablecloth.
"Things tense at the office, are they?" asked Strike.
"You could say that," replied Waldegrave, looking around again for the wine waiter. "It's sinking in. Now we know how Owen was killed. People are raising emails like idiots, pretending they never looked at the book, don't know how it ends. It's not so funny now."
"Was it funny before?" asked Strike.
"Well, yeah, it was, when people thought Owen had just done a runner. People love seeing the powerful ridiculed, don't they? They aren't popular men, either of them, Fancourt and Chard."
The wine waiter arrived and handed the list to Waldegrave.
"I'll get a bottle, shall I?"
said Waldegrave, scanning it. I take it this is on you.
Yeah, said Strike, not without trepidation.
Waldegrave ordered a bottle of Chateau Les Angars, which Strike saw with profound misgiving cost nearly 50 quid, though there were bottles on the list that cost nearly 200.
So, said Waldegrave with sudden bravado, as the wine waiter retreated, any leads yet? Know who did it?
Not yet, said Strike.
An uncomfortable beat followed. Waldegrave pushed his glasses up his sweaty nose. Sorry, he muttered. Crass, defense mechanism. I can't believe it. I can't believe it happened.
No one ever can, said Strike.
On a rush of confidence, Waldegrave said, I can't shake this mad bloody idea that Owen did it to himself, that he staged it.
Really? Said Strike, watching Waldegrave closely. I know he can't have done, I know that.
The editor's hands were playing a deft scale on the edge of the table now. It's so theatrical, how he was killed, so grotesque, and the awful thing. Best publicity any author ever got his book. God, Owen loved publicity. Poor Owen. He once told me, this isn't a joke, he once told me in all seriousness that he liked to get his girlfriend to interview him. Said it clarified his thought processes. I said, what do you use as a mic? Taking the mickey, you know. And you know what the silly sod said? Biros, mostly. Whatever's around.
Waldegrave burst into panting chuckles that sounded very like sobs.
Poor bastard, he said. Poor, silly bastard. Lost it completely at the end, didn't he? Well, I hope Elizabeth Tassel's happy, winding him up.
Their original waiter returned with a notebook.
What are you having? The editor asked Strike, focusing short-sightedly on his bill of fare.
The beef, said Strike,
who had had time to watch it being carved from the silver salver on a trolley that circulated the tables. He had not had Yorkshire pudding in years. Not, in fact, since the last time he had gone back to St. Maur's to see his aunt and uncle. Waldegrave ordered Dover sole, then craned his neck again to see whether the wine waiter was returning. When he caught sight of the man approaching with the bottle, he noticeably relaxed, sinking more comfortably into his chair. His glass filled, he drank several mouthfuls before sighing like a man who had received urgent medical treatment.
You were saying Elizabeth Tassel wound quine up, Strike said.
Eh? Said Waldegrave, cupping his right hand around his ear. Strike remembered his one-sided deafness. The restaurant was indeed filling up, becoming noisier. He repeated his question more loudly.
Oh, yeah, said Waldegrave. Yeah, about Fancourt. The pair of them liked brooding on the wrongs Fancourt did them.
What wrongs? Asked Strike.
And Waldegrave swigged more wine.
Fancourt's been bad-mouthing them both for years.
Waldegrave scratched his chest absent-mindedly through his creased shirt and drank more wine.
Owen, because of that parody of his dead wife's novel. Liz, because she stuck by Owen. Mind you, nobody's ever blamed Fancourt for leaving Liz Tassel. The woman's a bitch. Down to about 2 clients now. Twisted. Probably spends her evenings working out how much she lost. 15% of Fancourt's royalties is big money. Book of dinners, film premieres. Instead, she gets Quine interviewing himself with a biro and burnt sausages in Dorcas Pengelly's back garden.
How do you know there were burnt sausages? Asked Strike.
Dorcas told me, said Waldegrave,
who had already finished his first glass of wine and was pouring a second. She wanted to know why Liz wasn't at the firm's anniversary party. When I told her about Bombix Morrie, Dorcas assured me Liz was a lovely woman. Lovely. Couldn't have known what was in Owen's book. Never have hurt anyone's feelings. Wouldn't hurt a bloody fly.
Ah! You disagree.
Bloody right I disagree. I've met people who got their start in Liz Tassel's office. They talk like kidnap victims who've been ransomed. Bully. Scary temper.
You think she put Quine up to writing the book?
Well, not directly, said Waldegrave. But you take a deluded writer who was convinced he wasn't a bestseller because people were jealous of him, or not doing their jobs right, and lock him in with Liz, who's always angry, bitter as sin, banging on about Fancourt doing them both down. And is it a surprise he gets wound up to fever pitch? She couldn't even be bothered to read his book properly. If he hadn't died, I'd say she got what she deserved. Silly mad bastard didn't just do over Fancourt, did he? Went after her as well. Ha ha! Went after bloody Daniel, went after me, went after everyone. Everyone!
In the manner of other alcoholics Strike had known, Jerry Waldegrave had crossed the line into drunkenness with two glasses of wine. His movements were suddenly clumsier, his manner more flamboyant.
Do you think Elizabeth Tassel egged Quine on to attack Fancourt?
Not a doubt of it, said Waldegrave. Not a doubt.
But when I met her, Elizabeth Tassel said that what Quine wrote about Fancourt was a lie, Strike told Waldegrave.
Eh?
Said Waldegrave again, cupping his ear.
She told me, said Strike loudly, that what Quine writes in Bombix Murray about Fancourt is false. That Fancourt didn't write the parody that made his wife kill himself. That Quine wrote it.
I'm not talking about that, said Waldegrave,
shaking his head as though Strike were being obtuse.
I don't mean forget it. Forget it.
He was more than halfway down the bottle already. The alcohol had induced a degree of confidence. Strike held back, knowing that to push would only induce the granite stubbornness of the drunk. Better to let him drift where he wanted to go, keeping one light hand on the tiller.
Owen liked me, Waldegrave told Strike. Oh, yeah. I knew how to handle him. Stoke that man's vanity and you could get him to do anything you wanted. Half an hour's praise before you ask him to change anything in the manuscript. Another half hour's praise before you ask him to make another change. Only way. He didn't really want to hurt me. Wasn't thinking straight, silly bastard. Wanted to get back on the telly. Thought everyone was against him. Didn't realize he was playing with fire. Mentally ill.
Waldegrave slumped in his seat, and the back of his head collided with that of a large, overdressed woman sitting behind him.
Sorry. Sorry.
While she glared over her shoulder, he pulled in his chair, causing the cutlery to rattle on the tablecloth.
So what? Strike asked. What was the cutter all about?
Huh?
Said Waldegrave. This time, Strike felt sure that the cupped ear was a pose.
The cutter.
Cutter?
Editor, obvious, said Waldegrave. And the bloody sack and the dwarf you try and drown?
Symbolic,
said Waldegrave, with an airy wave of the hand that nearly upset his wine glass.
Some idea of his I stifled, some bit of lovingly crafted prose I wanted to kill off hurt his feelings.
Strike, who had heard a thousand rehearsed answers, found the response too pat, too fluent, too fast.
Just that?
Well,
said Waldegrave, with a gasp of a laugh,
I've never drowned a dwarf, if that's what you're implying.
Drunks were always tricky interviewees. Back in the SIB, intoxicated suspects or witnesses had been a rarity. He remembered the alcoholic major whose 12-year-old daughter had disclosed sexual abuse at her school in Germany. When Strike had arrived at the family house, the major had taken a swing at him with a broken bottle. Strike had laid him out. But here in the civilian world, with the wine waiter hovering, this drunken, mild-mannered editor could choose to walk away, and there would be nothing Strike could do about it. He could only hope for a chance to double back to the subject of the cutter, to keep Waldegrave in his seat, to keep him talking. The trolley now wended its stately way to Strike's side. A rib of Scottish beef was carved with ceremony, while Waldegrave was presented with Dover sole.
No taxes for 3 months,
Strike told himself sternly.
salivating as his plate was heaped with Yorkshire puddings, potatoes and parsnips. The trolley trundled away again. Waldegrave, who was now two-thirds of the way down his bottle of wine, contemplated his fish as though he was not quite sure how it had ended up in front of him, and put a small potato in his mouth with his fingers.
"Did Quine discuss what he was writing with you before he handed in his manuscripts?" asked Strike.
"Never," said Waldegrave. "The only thing he ever told me about Bombyx Mori was that the silkworm was a metaphor for the writer, who has to go through agonies to get at the good stuff. That was it."
"He never asked for your advice or input?"
"No, no, Owen always thought he knew best."
"Is that usual?"
"Writers vary," said Waldegrave. "But Owen was always up the secretive end of the scale. He liked the big reveal, you know, appealed to his sense of drama."
"Police will have asked you about your movements after you got the book, I suppose," said Strike casually.
"Yeah, been through all that,"
said Waldegrave indifferently. He was attempting, without much success, to pry spines out of the Dover sole he had recklessly asked to be left on the bone.
"Got the manuscript on Friday. Didn't look at it until the Sunday."
"You were meant to be away, weren't you?"
"Paris," said Waldegrave. "Anniversary weekend. Didn't happen."
"Something came up?"
Waldegrave emptied the last of the wine into his glass. Several drops of the dark liquid fell onto the white tablecloth and spread.
"Had a row, a bloody awful row on the way to Heathrow. Turned round, went back home."
"Rough," said Strike.
"On the rocks for years," said Waldegrave,
abandoning his unequal struggle with the soul and throwing down his knife and fork with a clatter that made nearby diners look round.
"Jojo's grown up. No point anymore. Splitting up."
"I'm sorry to hear that," said Strike. Waldegrave shrugged lugubriously and took more wine. The lenses of his horn-rimmed glasses were covered in fingerprints, and his shirt collar was grubby and frayed. He had the look, thought Strike, who was experienced in such matters, of a man who has slept in his clothes.
"You went straight home after the row, did you?"
"It's a big house. No need to see each other if we don't want to."
The drops of wine were spreading like crimson blossoms on the snowy tablecloth.
"Black spot. That's what this reminds me of," said Waldegrave. "Treasure Island, you know? Black spot. Suspicion on everyone who read that bloody book. Everyone looking sideways at everyone else. Everyone who knows the ending suspect. Police in my bloody office, everyone staring." "I read it on Sunday," he said, lurching back to Strike's question. "And I told Liz Tassel what I thought of her, and life went on. Owen not answering his phone. Thought he was probably having a breakdown. Had my own bloody problems. Daniel Chard going berserk. Fuck him. Resigned, had enough. Accusations, no more. Being bloody bawled out in front of the whole office. No more."
"Accusations?" asked Strike.
His interview technique was starting to feel like the dexterous flicking of Sabutio football figures, the wobbling interviewee directed by the right light touch. Strike had had an Arsenal set in the 70s. He had played Dave Polworth's custom-painted Plymouth Argyles, with both boys lying belly down on Dave's mum's hearthrug.
"Dan thinks I gossiped about him to Owen, bloody idiot. Thinks the world doesn't know, been gossiped for years. Didn't have to tell Owen, everyone knows."
"That Chard's gay."
"Gay, who cares? Repressed. Not sure Dan even knows he's gay. But he likes pretty young men, likes painting them in the nude. Common knowledge."
"Did he offer to paint you?" asked Strike.
"Christ, no," said Waldegrave. "Joan North told me years ago."
"Ah!"
He had caught the wine waiter's eye.
"Another glass of this, please."
Strike was only grateful he had not asked for a bottle.
I'm sorry, sir, we don't do that by the...
Anything, then, Red, anything.
Years ago this was, Waldegrave went on, picking up where he had left off. Dan wanted Joe to pose for him. Joe told him to piss off. Common knowledge for years.
He leaned back, ramming the large woman behind him again, who unfortunately was now eating soup. Strike watched her angry dining companion summon a passing waiter to complain. The waiter bent down to Waldegrave and said apologetically, yet with firmness, "Would you mind pulling in your chair, sir? The lady behind you."
"Sorry, sorry."
Waldegrave tugged himself nearer Strike, placed his elbows on the table, pushed his tangled hair out of his eyes, and said loudly,
"Head up his bloody arse!"
"Who?" asked Strike, finishing with regret the best meal he had had in a long time.
"Dan. Handed the bloody company on a plate. Rolling in it all his life. Let him live in the country and paint his house, boy, if that's what he wants. Had enough of it. Start my own bloody company."
Waldegrave's mobile phone rang. It took him a while to locate it. He peered over his glasses at the caller's number before answering.
"What's up, Jojo?"
Busy though the restaurant was, Strike heard the response. Shrill, distant screaming down the line. Waldegrave looked horrified.
"Jojo, are you..."
But then, the doughy, amiable face became tauter than Strike could have believed. Veins stood out on Waldegrave's neck, and his mouth stretched in an ugly snarl.
"Fuck you!"
he said, and his voice carried loudly to all the surrounding tables, so that 50 heads jerked upwards, conversation stalled.
"Do not call me on Jojo's number! No, you drunken fucking... You heard me! I drink because I'm fucking married to you! That's why!"
The overweight woman behind Waldegrave looked around, outraged. Waiters were glaring. One had so far forgotten himself as to have paused with a Yorkshire pudding halfway to a Japanese businessman's plate. The decorous gentleman's club had doubtless seen other drunken brawls, but they could not fail to shock among the dark wood panels, the glass chandeliers, and the bills of fare, where everything was stolidly British, calm, and staid.
"Well, whose fucking fault's that?"
shouted Waldegrave. He staggered to his feet, ramming his unfortunate neighbour yet again, but this time there was no remonstrance from her companion. The restaurant had fallen silent. Waldegrave was weaving his way out of it, a bottle and a third to the bad, swearing into his mobile, and Strike, stranded at the table, was amused to find in himself some of the disapproval felt in the mess for a man who cannot hold his drink.
"Bill, please," said Strike to the nearest gaping waiter.
He was disappointed that he had not gotten to sample the spotted dick, which he had noted on the bill of fare, but he must catch Waldegrave if he could. While the diners muttered and watched him out of the corners of their eyes, Strike paid, pulled himself up from the table, and, leaning on his stick, followed in Waldegrave's ungainly footsteps. From the outraged expression of the maitre d', and the sound of Waldegrave still yelling just outside the door, Strike suspected that Waldegrave had taken some persuasion to leave the premises. He found the editor propped up against the cold wall to the left of the doors. Snow was falling thickly all around them. The pavements were crunchy with it, passers-by muffled to the ears. The backdrop of solid grandeur removed, Waldegrave no longer looked like a vaguely scruffy academic. Drunk, grubby and crumpled, swearing into a phone disguised by his large hand, he might have been a mentally ill down-and-out.
"Not my fucking fault, you stupid bitch. Did I write the fucking thing, did I? You'd better fucking talk to her then, hadn't you? If you don't, I will. Don't you threaten me, you ugly fucking slut. If you kept your legs closed, you fucking heard me."
Waldegrave saw Strike. He
He stood gaping for a few seconds, then cut the call. The mobile slipped through his fumbling fingers and landed on the snowy pavement.
"Bollocks," said Jerry Waldegrave.
The wolf had turned back into the sheep. He groped with bare fingers for the phone in the slush around his feet, and his glasses fell off. Strike picked them up for him.
"Thanks. Thanks. Sorry about that. Sorry."
Strike saw tears on Waldegrave's puffy cheeks as the editor rammed his glasses back on. Stuffing the cracked phone into his pocket, he turned an expression of despair upon the detective.
"It's ruined my fucking life," he said. "That book. And I thought, Owen, one thing he held sacred, father-daughter. One thing."
With another dismissive gesture, Waldegrave turned and walked away, weaving badly, thoroughly drunk. He had had, the detective guessed, at least a bottle before they met. There was no point following him. Watching Waldegrave disappear into the swirling snow, past the Christmas shoppers, scrambling, laden, along the slushy pavements, Strike remembered a hand closing ungently on an upper arm, a stern man's voice, an angrier young woman's. "Mummy's made a beeline. Why don't you grab her?" Turning up his coat collar, Strike thought he knew now what the meaning was. Of a dwarf in a bloody bag, of the horns under the cutter's cap, and, cruelest of all, the attempted drowning.
Chapter 37. When I am provoked to fury, I cannot incorporate with patience and reason. William Congreve, The Double Dealer.
Strike set out for his office beneath a sky of dirty silver, his feet moving with difficulty through the rapidly accumulating snow, which was still falling fast. Though he had touched nothing but water, he felt a little drunk on good rich food, which gave him the false sense of well-being that Waldegrave had probably passed some time mid-morning drinking in his office. The walk between Simpson's in the Strand and his drafty little office on Denmark Street would take a fit and unimpaired adult perhaps a quarter of an hour. Strike's knee remained sore and overworked, but he had just spent more than his entire week's food budget on a single meal. Lighting a cigarette, he limped away through the knife-sharp cold, head bowed against the snow, wondering what Robin had found out at the Bridlington bookshop. As he walked past the fluted columns of the Lyceum Theatre, Strike pondered the fact that Daniel Chard was convinced that Jerry Waldegrave had helped Quine write his book, whereas Waldegrave thought that Elizabeth Tassel had played upon his sense of grievance until it had erupted into print. Were these, he wondered, simple cases of displaced anger? Having been balked of the true culprit by Quine's gruesome death, were Chard and Waldegrave seeking living scapegoats on whom to vent their frustrated fury? Or were they right to detect, in Bombyx Mori, a foreign influence? The scarlet facade of the Coach and Horses in Wellington Street constituted a powerful temptation as he approached it, the stick doing heavy duty now, and his knee complaining. Warmth, beer, and a comfortable chair. But a third lunchtime visit to the pub in a week, not a habit he ought to develop. Jerry Waldegrave was an object lesson in where such behaviour might lead. He could not resist an envious glance through the window as he passed, towards lights gleaming on brass beer pumps and convivial men with slacker consciences than his own. He saw her out of the corner of his eye. Tall and stooping in her black coat, hands in her pockets, scurrying along the slushy pavements behind him. His stalker and would-be attacker of Saturday night. Strike's pace did not falter, nor did he turn to look at her. He was not playing games this time. There would be no stopping to test her amateurish stalking style, no letting her know that he had spotted her.
On he walked without looking over his shoulder, and only a man or woman similarly expert in counter-surveillance would have noticed his casual glances into helpfully positioned windows and reflective brass door plates. Only they could have spotted the hyper-alertness disguised as inattentiveness. Most killers were slapdash amateurs. That was how they were caught. To persist after their encounter on Saturday night argued high-caliber recklessness, and it was on this that Strike was counting as he continued up Wellington Street, outwardly oblivious to the woman following him with a knife in her pocket. As he crossed Russell Street, she had dodged out of sight, faking entrance to the Marquis of Anglesey, but soon reappeared, dodging in and out of the square pillars of an office block and lurking in a doorway to allow him to pull ahead. Strike could barely feel his knee now. He had become 6'3" of highly concentrated potential. This time, she had no advantage. She would not be taking him by surprise. If she had a plan at all, he guessed that it was to profit from any available opportunity. It was up to him to present her with an opportunity she dare not let pass, and to make sure she did not succeed. Past the Royal Opera House with its classical portico, its columns and statues. In Endell Street, she entered an old red telephone box, gathering her nerve, no doubt, double-checking that he was not aware of her. Strike walked on, his pace unchanging, his eyes on the street ahead. She took confidence, and emerged again onto the crowded pavement, following him through harried passers-by with carrier bags swinging from their hands, drawing closer to him as the street narrowed, flitting in and out of doorways. As he drew nearer to the office, he made his decision, turning left off Denmark Street into Flitcroft Street, which led to Denmark Place, where a dark passage, plastered with flyers for bands, led back to his office. Would she dare? As he entered the alleyway, his footsteps echoing a little off the dank walls, he slowed imperceptibly. Then he heard her coming, running at him. Wheeling around on his sound left leg, he flung out his walking stick. There was a shriek of pain as her arm met it. The Stanley knife was knocked out of her hand, hit the stone wall, rebounded, and narrowly missed Strike's eye. He had her now in a ferocious grip that made her scream. He was afraid that some hero would come to her aid, but no one appeared. And now speed was essential. She was stronger than he had expected and struggled ferociously, trying to kick him in the balls and claw his face. With a further economical twist of his body, he had her in a headlock, her feet skidding and scrambling on the damp alley floor. As she writhed in his arms trying to bite him, he stooped to pick up the knife, pulling her down with him so that she almost lost her footing, then, abandoning the walking stick, which he could not carry while managing her, he dragged her out onto Denmark Street. He was fast, and she so winded by the struggle that she had no breath to yell. The short, cold street was empty of shoppers, and no passers-by on Charing Cross Road noticed anything amiss as he forced her the short distance to the Black Street door. "Need in, Robin, quickly!" he shouted on the intercom, slamming his way through the outer door as soon as Robin had buzzed it open. Up the metal steps he dragged her, his right knee now protesting violently, and she started shrieking, the screams echoing around the stairwell. Strike saw movement behind the glass of the dour and eccentric graphic designer who worked in the office beneath his.
"Just messing around,"
he bellowed at the door, heaving his pursuer upstairs.
"Cormoran? What?"
"Oh my God," said Robin, staring down from the landing.
"You can't. What are you playing at? Let her go."
"She's just tried to bloody knife me again," panted Strike,
and with a gigantic final effort, he forced his pursuer over the threshold.
"Lock the door,"
he shouted at Robin, who had hurried in behind them and obeyed. Strike threw the woman onto the mock leather sofa. The hood fell back to reveal a long pale face with large brown eyes and thick dark wavy hair that fell to her shoulders. Her fingers terminated in pointed crimson nails. She looked barely 20.
You bastard! You bastard! She tried to get up, but Strike was standing over her, looking murderous, so she thought better of it, slumping back